Be Jason Davison from the University of Nevada Cooperative Extension on the impacts of short-term irrigation and seeding grass cover crops, establishment of native shrubs and abandoned farmlands in the Great Basin.
Thank you. Pick this up just a little bit. If I can. I guess we should have added organic in our title of our talk compared to the last group. Anyway, thanks for coming this morning. Today I'm going to report on a project that myself and several colleagues did over a five-year period where we looked at the impact of both short-term irrigation and perennial grass seed as a cover crop on establishment of this native shrubs on abandoned farmlands. There was a whole bunch of information that was gathered on this particular project. However, today, because of the time limitations, I'm just going to talk about the vegetation, above ground vegetation, but we looked at erosion and root mass and a whole bunch of different things. All right, in Nevada, and actually in several western states, we're seeing a dramatic decrease in actively farmed ground. And in Nevada, it's been about 34% from 92 through 2011, according to the Ag Statistical Service. And the primary reason for this is water is being purchased for other purposes, such as urban uses and environmental uses, and transferred off to land. And besides just the loss of productivity, the other problem with that is a natural revegetation of these lands just doesn't occur. And there's several reasons for that, which I'll cover in just a second. But what happens is, after we strip these waters, is that these lands become a significant source of wind-eroded soils, as well as exotic weed infestation, so they're a real problem. Most of the Great Basin and in Nevada, the lands that were originally shrub-dominated types. In this particular picture, this is what you'd see typical in western Nevada, which was these are salt desert shrub types dominated by atriplex species. And then we also in Nevada, we have at the higher elevations, northern and central portions, we'll have shrublands dominated by artemisia, primarily Wyoming big sage. And so they're not really grasslands. Now, I spoke about the fact that there's some real challenges for these things. And some of these challenges include if we do get adequate precipitation for after we strip the water off, we see a real intense competition, primarily from annual weeds, both grasses and broadleaves, for any kind of establishment and survival. And then to compound that problem, we deal with there's a lack of labeled pest control to spray over top of some of these native shrubs we're trying to establish. So it's weed competition becomes a major problem. The major problem, though, is just a lack of rainfall and when it occurs. I mean, we're talking 5-6 inches annually, most of it occurring in the wintertime, and then we have real high solar radiation and a lot of wind. And anybody that grows plants knows that's a bad combination. And finally, economics. In Nevada, once we strip water off the land, we have no dry land production in Nevada. It's 100% irrigated. And unless your land is adjacent to an urban area that you can perhaps develop, the land value goes to nothing. And so when we strip the water off of that, there's very little economic incentive to come in and do something about it. And so it's creating real problems. So what we wanted to see, based on some previous work we've done, is that can we use short-term irrigation and perennial grasses to try to facilitate this shrubland restoration? Specifically, we wanted to look at whether or not short-term irrigation facilitates both grass and shrub establishment and then survival over time. Second thing we wanted to look at was do grasses suppress weeds and reduce erosion? And finally, do the grasses facilitate long-term shrub establishment? Because that's our ultimate goal, is to get these things back into some semblance of a native vegetation type. We did this work in the Mason Valley, which is about 90 miles south of Reno. It's one of our major farming areas. About 120, 930 millimeters of precipitation annually. We did 3 reps per site, and there were 2 watering treatments, irrigated and non-irrigated, were the main plots. Irrigated, the first year we put on about 3/4 of normal irrigation, which is about 85 centimeters. Then the second year we cut it way back to about 25%, about 30 centimeters for that year, with the idea of we're going to establish it and then kind of wean them off of it. There were 6 planting treatments, and there were 2 sites. One site hadn't produced anything for 20, 25 years, had been irrigated previously and was basically bare. The second site was a growing alfalfa site that we then came in and established our plots on with the intention of trying to make or mimic what would happen if water had recently been pulled off of that. These were the grass species we used. We had four cool season species, Indian rice grass, two varieties, basin wild rye, one variety, western wheat grass with two varieties, and then beardless wheat. We also came in and tried to seed inland saltgrass, which is a warm season perennial species. Very difficult to seed, almost no germination, but it's a major component, especially on these salt desert shrub types, and we wanted to see if we could have some success with that particular grass. This is the plot layout that we had. As you can see, we randomized the planting treatments as well as the irrigation treatments. This is a visual of the two sites, the south site, what we call the 5C site, again was fallow. The north site was a growing alfalfa field, and we came in early in 2007 and used herbicides and tillage to get rid of the alfalfa, is basically what we did. Now, we looked at perennial grasses because they're an important component of a lot of our shrublands, especially at a little higher elevation or further north. But the main reason we looked at them is because they're easier to establish from seed, and we can fight the weed problem with broadleaf herbicides. There's a lot of them out there, and so we can kind of exhaust that weed seed soil bank is what we were looking at. They do a good job of suppressing weeds, but they also compete with the shrubs we're putting in. But over time, what we found in the past is once we pull irrigation off of these sites, the grass species begin to decline, and if we have an adequate shrub population, it'll tend to increase. And so we wanted to see if we could kind of speed that up a little bit. So in November 2007, we came in and used that Struax seed drill to plant all these cool season species. And that year, the winter of 2007-2008, we actually got enough precip to have pretty good germination and early establishment of the grasses. This slide was taken in April of 2008 when we were just starting our irrigation, and you can see that we had a pretty good population of grasses, and this is unusual. It happens in Nevada maybe one out of 20 years, something like that. Now, the reason we're looking at short-term irrigation is it's usually possible, especially with newer sites, to use water for a couple years because it takes a couple years in our laws to transfer the water off. You can't just say, I'm going to sell my water and tomorrow it's gone. And so it stays on the land for a couple years. Also, a lot of times, our irrigation infrastructure is still in place. Even on some of these ones that haven't been irrigated for a long time, if there's irrigated sites around it, we still have the infrastructure that we can get some water on it. Now, politically, you can't, about 2 years is all you're going to get away with as far as putting water on the ground. And especially when you want to do it, you want to do less than normal farming practices because there's a lot of history in this, and are we just, trying to keep the farming on the ground longer. And so we looking at this short-term irrigation, we wanted to see if it was really going to lead to long-term success. And will it really increase the likelihood of the grass shrub facilitation, what we were looking for? This slide was taken in May of 2009. You can see we had 2 years of irrigation here, and we had very good establishment. This is a non-irrigated plot, and as you can see, we had pretty good germination the first year, but by 2009 it was pretty well going out the door because 2009 went back to our normal precip. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to look at transplanting shrubs as kind of a seed source because on a lot of these fields there is no native seed source anywhere close. And so what we did is we grew these four species outside for 2 years so they were hardened off, and then we transplanted seven of them into each plot. And the four species we looked at were four-winged saltbush, shad scale, black greasewood, and Wyoming big sage. These are all major components of the shrublands that used to be converted to farmlands, and so these are some of the major subspecies. This is again 2009. You can see this is one of our little Wyoming big sage, and you can barely see a little bit of grass species here that we're still hanging on after a year of no irrigation. Here we have, you can't see it, but this little red flag here is a shrub. We've got another one, I think, right over here. And you can see that there's obviously a lot of competition between the grasses and the shrubs. But what we are banking on or hoping for is that the supplemental irrigation would kind of overcome some of that. And so that the shrubs would become established and then the grasses would go out. So let's look at a little bit of the results. 2009, we had a real surprising result. Water grows grasses. Now, really not too earth-shattering there. You can see this is density with... And this is western wheatgrass, a rhizomonas species, so you can see it's much higher than the others. But basically, you can really see the differences between irrigation and non-irrigation. Now, by 2011, water had been off for a couple years. You can see the grass population had dropped dramatically, and this is what we would expect. And we had just a little tiny bit of inland salt grass here. But basically, there was no establishment. So what we had in this treatment here was we had a drill treatment in July with no establishment. And we also had a control where we didn't drill it except in November. So it was kind of a mechanical treatment, and it's important because you'll see in just a second. Now, what about weed densities? Grass did a good job. This is the area that we had no grass is on these two, and you can see weed densities were fairly high as compared to where we had successful grass establishment. However, by 2011, we look over here, you can see grass densities. In the previous slide, you saw they were declining. Weed densities are going up, and so we kind of saw that go away, and that's typically what we see. So the planted grass really did have some benefits. As I said, we didn't talk about erosion, but the erosion was much less on these areas that had planted species as compared to the ones that didn't. But it did reduce weed density and biomass for the first 2 years. But we had a spatial disconnect between shrubs, success, and grass production. And it was shown in this slide. Here you can see this is, again, that treated mechanically treated plot that I was talking about had no grass competition but was drilled in July. And you can see we've looked at percent cover of shrubs was significantly different than any of the other treatments. The interesting thing was both of these were primarily volunteer shrubs. On this site, there was a undisturbed site adjacent to it, and so we did have a seed source. And so by 2011, we had a substantial increase in shrubs on this treatment, but primarily volunteer. Now, we look in 2012, the shrubs were getting bigger, and you can see the cover went up, but the fact of the matter is that still this treatment was significantly different than the other treatments that we looked at. Those were, again, primarily volunteer. Now, if we look at, though, the transplanted shrub survival, which was relatively low, about 10% is all that survived, still this treatment here has done a pretty good job for us. This is a slide taken in July of 2012 of the plots area, and if we overlay the drilled saltgrass treatment with irrigation, you can see there was definitely a relationship. It did pretty well. Now, the interesting thing is when you overlay the drilled saltgrass with no irrigation, look at this Rep 1, the treatment with no irrigation, and still we had tremendous shrub establishment. All this was volunteer. The majority of it was volunteer. The other two's not quite so good, but definitely there was something going on with this thing. So if we look at the results, a summary, did initial irrigation facilitate grass establishment and survival? Absolutely. And over time, though, the grass densities declined, which is exactly what we expect and what we're kind of hoping for, to be honest with you, if we can establish the shrubs. Did the initial irrigation facilitate shrub establishment and survival? Yeah, it did, although the survival rates were still pretty low. I mean, again, we were 8-10%, not all that shiny. Did they suppress weeds and reduce erosion? Yep, they did, and as expected, as time went along, that kind of went away. Did they facilitate shrubs? The big question, and the answer is no, they didn't. There was absolutely a disconnect between this where grass populations were high and where shrub survival was the highest. So why? So we sat down and kind of scratched our heads a little bit and thought of some potential reasons why we saw this differences. One, we had the drilling and lack of competition in July. And so maybe you're looking at increased infiltration because you've opened that soil surface a little bit. These were sandy loam, so we didn't have a lot of crusting problems, but perhaps that made a difference. Maybe it created safe microsites for seedlings and or trapped some of these wind dispersed seeds. The area was downwind of where the seed source was. Or maybe we exposed some shrub seeds that were already there in the soil and we brought them up through that drilling process. Might have been timing. Salt grass was planted in July. The rest of them were planted in November. And so maybe what we had was more shrub seed capture because they're going to shed seeds in the fall and winter, and they're going to be available during that spring windy period. Another idea that maybe came about was this area, and most of Nevada, has a lot of kangaroo rats, and they are known for seed caches, and maybe we exposed some of these seed caches. We really didn't know. Now, fortunately, we're lucky in that we have got additional funding, and we're pursuing some of these as we speak. Started a new project this year, and so hopefully in a couple of years I'll come back with some a little more definitive answers, because right now it's pure speculation, to be honest with you. The good news is that I took this picture of the site in May of 2014, and we're well on our way to establishing a good, solid shrub component. The interesting thing is most of these shrubs, well, the shrubs were dominated by two species, four-winged saltbush and rubber rabbit brush, Chrysanthemis nauseosus. Not generally considered a real desirable species, but when we're dealing with these tough sites, pretty much we've come to the agreement among ourselves and many of the people that are funding these things that anything is better than nothing. And so if we can establish things like rabbit brush and four-winged being a pretty desirable species, we're money ahead of the game. And you can see this one, we're well on our way to successful establishment. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Any questions for Jason?
Got off pretty easy.
Oh, I've got one. Is there going to be a natural succession over time, or will you pretty much... what you have now in 2014, is that going to be pretty much what you expect, or do you anticipate these changing over time?
Typically what you'll expect on these sites is you'll expect the population to expand if you're successful over 5 to 6, 7, 8 years, and then it comes into a balance. And so it's going to be relatively, as the picture I showed before, it'll be relatively dispersed shrubs, but enough to hold the thing in place is basically what we're trying to do. And so, you'll see that. It's interesting, on this once in 20 years when we have high precip, what you'll see is you'll see an explosion in seedlings, grasses and other shrubs. The vast majority of them do not survive until, even 1 year. And so it's kind of an episodic thing. If you have an extremely wet year on some of these sites that haven't been revegetated, sometimes you'll see a few shrubs get established, and then over long term, we actually see some expansion and then reestablishment. But we've got a lot of this ground that hasn't been farmed in 50 years, and it's pretty much annual weeds, winter annuals primarily, although Russian thistle and some of these things come in the summertime if we get a little bit extra precip, and they just haven't changed at all. And the biggest problem we deal with also is just the economics. When you're doing this kind of stuff, one of the things that we're looking at is how to do this on a cheap basis, because once this water's pulled, it's in Nevada, it's the value of the land. The land is worth nothing. And so, yes, sir?
Are these lands grazed?
Yes.
Yeah, I think he was kind of at the same kind of question I would have, but, the species that you have coming in there now, the four-winged saltbush and the rabbit...
Rabbit bush? Uh-huh.
I guess where I'm leaning to is, how does that compare with kind of the normal succession that you would see in those areas over time? And maybe what you have is you actually are more successful than you think you are.
Yeah, generally a four-winged saltbush is definitely a component of the highest successional stage. You'd expect to see it in there. Rabbit brush is generally something that comes in earlier, is what happens, and then will go out over time. But I'll tell you, on some of the work I've done 10 years ago, I've got 10 years worth of data looking at it, the rabbit brush has pretty much stayed where it's at. I don't know whether or not it'll change over time, but it's one of these ones that we've actually had landowners didn't want us to put any rabbit brush in because it's not very desirable. I think the next question is going to talk about grazing. But the fact of the matter is most of these lands, because of the lack of precipitation and of salts in the soils and the other limitations, they're very limited as far as what they can be used for. And so right now we're taking rabbit brush and happy to have it. But in the long term, we'd like to see more atroplexes, some of those species and things like that. Yes, sir?
Yes, are these lands grazed, and has that been taken into consideration in the design of the study?
Yes. When I say, are they grazed? previously, before they were farm ground, you know, it was livestock is really what it was. Now, generally speaking, a lot of these grounds have been broken up into smaller units, and because the productivity on them is so low, they're not typically grazed. And so it's one of those things. Now, it was interesting. On this particular site, the northern site, a guy bought the ranch. Both of these were on private ranches, two different owners at the time we started. A guy came in and bought the northern ranch and was a cattleman, put livestock on it, and honestly pretty much beat the more desirable species out. The forewing and stuff went out on it. I mean, you can use them, but it's extremely limited if you want to keep it there. Now, I don't know what's going to happen to the site because he just bought this ranch this spring. And so we may see some changes in the future. But generally speaking, these things, because most of this, especially on western Nevada, they're not real large. A big place would be 200 acres. They are, they're not really used for much once that water's pulled off. If they're grazed at all, it's primarily in the wintertime because they're shrub dominated. Thank you.
If not, thank you.